Good morning, folks, and welcome back here to the Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We are about midway, is that right?
Yes.
Midway through the session?
Yes.
There's a lot going on in Annapolis, and we have four of our leading delegates here to talk about what's happening in Annapolis, the issues that are at the forefront of your minds. We just saw the Galtra poll that came out last night. Was it last night? This looks like it was a long time ago, but first time I got it was last night, about where people stand on the issues. And we want to hear your thoughts on all of that at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org by email. You can also tweet us at Mark Steiner. And we are here with Delegate Cheryl Glenn from District 45 in Baltimore. Of course, Delegate Glenn is the chair of the Black Caucus in the state legislature. Good to have you with us. Delegate,
Thank you. Always good
to see you.
Yes, you too.
And in the House here, also District 45. It must be a 45 day in the House. Delegate Corey McCrae, of course, District 45 Delegate. Good to have you in the studio. Corey, welcome.
Mark, thank you.
Joining us by phone is Delegate Ana Sol Gutierrez from District 18 of Montgomery County. Ana, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And Delegate Antonio Hayes is with us from District 40 here in Baltimore City. And Antonio, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Mark. Glad to be on.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888 to join in on these conversations. So there's so much going on in Annapolis. And I'm curious what our listeners think. At 410-319-8888, because I do want to get to some issues that really affect our schools in this state, which I think are really critical issues for us to wrestle with, no matter where we are, Baltimore City, Montgomery County, and more, and whether that formula that we use makes any sense anymore, if it has to be reworked, and how do we put that at the forefront, which seems to be what most people want in this state. But let me begin with some of the issues that the sick leave controversy that is happening in Annapolis. I think if I have it correct, Governor Hogan's bill, Governor Hogan wants to have sick leave, but only for companies that have 50 plus employees. The original bill was for 15 and more. So where is that?
House Bill 1, and I'm Delegate Glenn. I actually serve on the Economic Matters Committee. We voted that bill out on Friday. The House Bill 1, which is the bill that says if you have 15 employees or more, you must provide sick leave. And it's a very fair program. It's not onerous to any of our small businesses, as people think. And the point is, we can't afford not to do this. You know, restaurants have been shut down because of contamination of food products and so forth. And you want to know as a consumer, when you're going into a restaurant, and I use that as an example, that there's nobody sick that's touching your food. But when you're a low-wage employee and you're sick, you go to work because you can't afford to stay home. And so we want all of our people. We don't want people to come to work to make other people sick. It's non-productive. So it's time for the state of Maryland to do this, and we can do it.
So do we think, Ana Gutierrez, it will pass? And what will happen if the governor doesn't like it?
Hello, this is for me, Ana?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm a little bit on out of tune here. Well, I absolutely agree with my colleague, Delegate Glenn, that we absolutely need a sick leave bill. But we believe that this is not the bill, because what it does is that it tries to put a state cap, to what the process and the policy should be, when indeed we could have local bills that are more generous, as we have here in Montgomery County. And, it should still be something that is decided locally. We've had this kind of legislation here in Montgomery County for 2 years now. So I'm hoping that we'll be able to get the issues resolved, because clearly we must have sick leave available to every, especially to low-income employees, to be able to be treated the way most other employees are who work for large companies.
So how is it? Are you saying which bill are you referring to? The one that says for 15 or 50? I'm confused.
I'm talking about the minimum wage one.
Oh, minimum wage. We were talking about something else. That's okay. No. So I do want to get to minimum wage too as well. But we were talking about the
sick leave one.
Right.
How's Bill 1, Anna?
Oh, okay. I'm so sorry. I was just out of range when you were talking, and I thought we were talking about the minimum wage. No, absolutely. Sick leave. We've been trying this, as you well know, for several years now to get passage of this bill. It is so important. So many, especially low-wage workers, those who are on hourly wage that are not even given the full week's work of work hours, they are going to absolutely benefit, I think, from being able to accumulate some sick leave for their time that they need to spend on themselves, on their family. It's critical.
So, Corey, what would happen if will the governor sign this bill? If you pass the 15, raise that mic so we can hear you. There you go. If the bill is passed that says you have to have sick leave if you have 15 or more employees, will the governor sign it?
Not sure. we've seen the governor veto a lot of things. I remember going through a big fight with him with the restoring voting rights. So
right. We're
just not sure what the governor would do, and I don't want to make any calculations for the governor, but you just never know what he'll do. I thought restoring voting rights was good.
No, it's refreshing to find a political elected official who has a very short, quick answer to a question like that.
Straight to the point and very direct.
And Anna did bring up the minimum wage bill. And that what about the battle inside? It seems to be a battle that actually crosses a lot of political, conservative, liberal, even kind of many lines inside the House and the Senate over the issue of whether localities should be allowed to set a minimum wage, which is really interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, so why do you think there's such a divide here over the ability of, let's say, Baltimore City or Montgomery County to be able to set their own legislation when it comes to minimum wages? What are you going to say, Corey?
I think that you'll find that the Senate is a lot more conservative. The House is a little bit more progressive. I think that you have a large delegation within the House that believe that we should have $15 an hour. I think that it's something that our local jurisdictions want to do. We see that with Baltimore City and legislation being introduced. You see that in Montgomery County where legislation was introduced, and I believe that something's coming in Prince George's. So we see that it's a big fight, and I think that I stand 100% behind the 15. Let me first say that first. But I also believe that local jurisdictions should be able to decide amongst themselves.
But am I not right that, I mean, it was somebody, a delegate from Prince George's County who...
My chairman,
yes,
Delegate Derek Davis.
Who opposes...
Well, he put in a bill to preempt local authority. I had a conversation with my chairman about this. He feels strongly that this system ought to be the same statewide for minimum wage. However, I did express my disagreement, and I told him that I would not be supporting his bill, which is a tough position to be in with your chairman. However, 3 years ago, I put in a bill to bring the minimum wage in the city of Baltimore up to the same level as Prince George's and Montgomery County.
Which is 15?
No. It's a more progressive rate. It takes, and I don't know what that final number is, but it's a lot higher than the state level for minimum wage for the rest of the counties. And I was told that it had to be done by the city council the same way it was done in Prince George's and Montgomery County. So last year, when the Baltimore City Council had the legislation to increase the minimum wage, and some of the members of the council said that it ought to be done on the state level. I actually personally sent a letter to each and every member of the city council, including the president and the mayor, to explain to them that the state was not going to do it. They say, at that point, my chairman was saying that the state wouldn't touch it, that it had to be done on a local level. So I've said to him, I said, we can't go back and forth like this. And the local jurisdictions, I agree with Delegate McCray, should have the right, when you look at their economy, should have the right to set their minimum wage rates as they see fit.
Antonio, you want to leap in on this? We haven't heard from you yet. Antonio, are you there?
Sorry. Yeah, Mark, I had you guys on mute, so you didn't hear any interference noise in the back. But no, I agree with my colleagues. I think, you know, local jurisdictions, you know, we shouldn't handicap them and, you know, being able to part of the decision. But it would be great if, you know, the state showed some leadership on this and set the minimum wage at a reasonable rate. But at the same time, we also need to give, you know, the local jurisdictions the ability to make their own decisions as well.
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
If I can jump in, I really think that we need to be very clear. The introducing the statewide bill was really a way to counter and undermine the local efforts to increase the minimum wage. There really should not be any role for the state to tell a jurisdiction what it considers needs to be the minimum wage. We know that there's different wealth power and wealth bases in the different counties, and we're competing with the district in Montgomery County and in Prince George's County for our employees, and we know that there is a higher cost of living in our area than perhaps in rural Maryland, Western Maryland, Southern Maryland. So I really believe that coming forth with this statewide bill, which, as I read in the Post yesterday, Derek Davis has decided to, that it's not the year, is what he says, that it will not go forth. I really think that it had a double intention to really undermine the whole effort of increases in the minimum wage statewide.
Well, I just wanted to say I'm very, very proud of those young folks and those senior legislators down at the city council for having the fortitude and the guts to be able to push this legislation. First of all, this is a piece of legislation that will help the 7th, the 9th, the 12th, the 13th district, the districts that are plagued by poverty, plagued by abandoned houses, plagued by so many structural challenges in front of us. And this is not easy. But let's remember that Baltimore City was the first to ever raise the minimum wage across the state of Maryland for the first time back in the 60s when that was just a buck. So it was Baltimore City that had the guts to do it first.
I do remember all that. so there's some questions here that are kind of broader let me ask about. And I'm just curious your opinions on this before we hit some of the other bills that I know you're all wrestling with around transportation, which is a huge one, the ethics bill that the governor is pushing, the ethics legislation he's pushing as well. But we're facing a lot right now in the state and country, and there are, you know, three facilities in the state of Maryland that are being used to house undocumented people who are being arrested. There was a man, and as example, Sabando Rodriguez Hernandez, who was arrested here in Baltimore City by ICE in his car at 2 o'clock in the morning. He was a businessman, had a barbershop, was a community leader, and is now in Frederick awaiting deportation and the fight around that. And city jail here in Baltimore City is state-run, not city-run, so it could also become a facility that holds people. Mm-hmm. So what kind of conversations are you all having with each other around this? I haven't seen any specific legislation going on, but I'm just curious about what the tenor is at the moment.
Well, the hearing is being held tomorrow for the Trust Act.
Which is what?
And that's a bill. I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
That's a bill that will give the Attorney General the authority to fight against those deportation efforts and other efforts that unnecessarily and unjustly impact our undocumented community. We don't want our citizens in Maryland to be at the whim of President Trump and his goon squad, you know, and that's the way I feel about it. So we have the Trust Act that all of the caucuses, the Black caucus, the Hispanic caucus, the Asian caucus, all of us are jointly supporting this legislation to arm our Attorney General with the powers that he needs to fight against any efforts that will unjustly impact our undocumented and immigrant community. Everybody is not undocumented. Just because you look Asian or you look Hispanic or what have you, that doesn't mean that you're undocumented. And you shouldn't be at the risk of being stopped in your car or taken away from your family at the airport just because you don't look like a blonde-haired, blue-eyed white person.
Jump in. The Trust Act is really something that makes a lot of sense, especially for police. We're saying that in Maryland, local police will not carry out federal immigration laws. They will not participate and help ICE and other federal law enforcement come after immigrants. We've seen how Donald Trump's policies, hatred, xenophobia, has really exploded onto our neighborhoods and to our communities with fear. There is fear of even going outside your house. And we also read that ICE is just tickle pink with this removal of any priorities. They are now, everybody is free game for them. And we're already seeing that there are people being detained outside churches. I heard of one person who was driving, their driver's license shows that in Maryland, for example, you can get a driver's license, and all it says is it's not useful for federal purposes. But that's an indication that a person may not be documented. And that person was detained. We are trying to locate him to see if he's still within ICE control. So the Trust Act, getting back, is simply limiting how the state will cooperate with deportation authorities. And what it wants to do is to restore community trust in police so that people will feel safe when crimes are committed, when there's domestic violence, to be able to have the police do their role. What they're intended to do is to keep safety and make sure that everyone feels safe in their home, in their community. We're having a big rally tonight. It's called Latino Night in Annapolis. Everyone is welcome. We're expecting thousands of people. And we already know that the House has more co-sponsors on that bill to pass. So we're hoping that Maryland, like California, becomes a state that says no to federal immigration agents and says yes to our local police doing what they are supposed to be doing, protecting everyone who lives in our state.
So one of the things clear, I mean, we heard from the governor's office how their reaction is like, again, this may be taking power away from the governor's office. Right?
The governor has not expressed anything at all that is counter to what Trump is doing. We've asked him to talk about the travel ban. He's been silent. We've asked him to talk about what is this increase in ICE raids right here in Maryland. He's been silent. So what power does he want? To be silent? That's not what we need governor. The governor of Virginia.
Let me, Sherilyn,
it's simple. It's really simple. We're not trying to take any power away from the governor because ultimately we hope to have a Democratic governor in 2018. What we're doing is simply protecting the people who elected us to office to do just that, to protect their interests, and that's what we're doing.
Now, all the delegates we do have with us today are all Democrats. We usually have a mix, but they're all Democrats today. It'll be no easy trick to beat Governor Hogan, given his ratings. 54% of the people or more, 6% like what he's doing, appreciate the governor. So this one might be, and I've not seen anybody. This is a strictly political question. I'm not asking you all to reveal who you like or don't like, but this is I haven't seen anybody actually out there now who says they're running for governor on the Democratic side, considering it, who could actually defeat and take on somebody who has the kind of the support, emotional support of so many people in the state.
Yeah.
just I like policies of the governor, and I don't like policies of the governor. I think that, you know, some of the policies I might like is the core funding. He helping to get demolition for the city. Thinking about the Justice Reinvestment Act. I know he supported that. I know that he didn't support Trump in the primary in general. I agree with that. But I also think that he has bad policies, just like the voucher and trying to push vouchers throughout the state of Maryland. We saw that the Boost program came to the state of Maryland, and I don't think that it was fully flushed out. That's why introducing bills like House Bill 696, which takes care of like non-discrimination language for non-public schools. We really didn't have that conversation, Mark, and I think it's a strong conversation that we should have. So while we have the governor in the governor's mansion, we also have the Senate in the General Assembly is supposed to be in the checks and balances. And I think there's a lot of challenging policies that come out of the governor's mansion that we are supposed to make sure that we protect Marylanders.
So we won't say too much now. Just throw out there as a question.
Well, we have a new Democratic National Committee chairperson who was just elected on Saturday. So I think that you will see some movement toward the elections in 2018 across the country.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how that all rolls out.
Yeah.
It's interesting to watch that. We'll be talking about that tomorrow as part of our program, actually. Going to some of the other issues, one of the things that, Cheryl, I wanted to bring up that I know you pushed was around the medical marijuana legislation.
Yes.
And then I have another question about all that for the three of you as well. But before we go to break, part of what motivated you to push what you're pushing was because no African Americans and no people of color actually had majority interests in any of the awards that were made, whether it was in the selling, the growing, or the distribution, or any of the other kind of contracts.
Yeah. You know, I've been fighting hard for this issue since being elected. In my first session of 2007, the commission is actually named after my mother, Natalie M. LaPrade, and who became the face of so many other patients who might have been able to benefit.
Oh, I do remember that. That's right.
Yeah, had she been able to have access to medical marijuana in the state of Maryland. So you know that I'm extremely frustrated and disappointed with the commission. So we are sponsoring legislation this year that we look at as corrective legislation. The commission was never established to be a regulatory commission. It was never anticipated that the commission would have the authority to issue licenses. It was only established in 2013 to be an advisory committee to the academic medical institutions. That was the only legislation that then Governor O'Malley would allow to pass. So in 2014, when my legislation finally made it through to create the program that we're supposed to have now, we never readdressed the commission because it was such a tough fight to get the bill passed. This commission has failed miserably in its duties. It ignored the legislation, the law that was enacted. The law said that the commission shall actively seek racial, ethnic, and geographic diversity. And that's the strongest language that you can have in law. And the commission didn't do any of that. In other words, the commission has not been able to justify or explain any of the decisions that they have made. There's been no transparency in their decision making. And you know, 2017, we demand transparency in government, you know, and they have no oversight. This commission has no oversight. They don't answer to the governor, to the Board of Public Works, to anybody. So we know that we have to change that. So our legislation disbands the commission in its current form and reestablishes a division under DHMH so that it would have the proper authority that it should have. And it would be composed of members appointed by the governor, the Senate president, and the speaker. And those members would have to be confirmed. But the biggest part, we are not fighting against the licenses that have already been preliminarily awarded. We're not trying to take that away because we know it's not the fault of the people who went through the process. So we're adding additional licenses that will be targeted for African Americans.
So I'd have another question about that, but I think a short break.
Okay.
And we want to talk about that and the other legislation around drug use that is being debated in the House and the Senate right now, as well as looking at education itself and the formulas that we use. Are they adequate? Do we need to change the education funding formula for the state of Maryland? 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on what's facing us here in the state of Maryland. It's your state. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And on our way back to our conversation with our delegates, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, has been helping its members and its community prosper for the last 80 years. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. Belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org. It's MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. We are here with Delegate Cheryl Glenn from District 45, Delegate Corey McCray from District 45, Delegate Ana Sol Gutierrez from District 18 in Montgomery County, and Delegate Antonio Hayes from District 40 in Baltimore City, and you all are 410-319-8888 to join in on this conversation. One of the things that, you know, when you look at this marijuana legislation that happened with medical marijuana, and even when you look at the battle going over around who's allowed to sell beer in breweries in the state, right? They're not minor issues in the sense that you know, that if there's any place it seems to me that a free market could flourish, it's in small businesses. I mean, I know we have to regulate large businesses, especially because around pollution, about job discrimination, and so many other things that you have to control this gigantic capitalist monolith before it eats us all alive. Right. But and when it comes to like on the ground, I mean, it seems to me like from the beginning, medical marijuana, and now with these kind of breweries and stuff, the people who distribute for the largest distributors are trying to stop the ability for people to be able to brew their own beer and sell it in their own places around the state. I mean, this seems to be the places where you should let businesses flourish, hire people, grow, compete, and see what falls out, right? I mean, especially with medical marijuana, why couldn't, you know, if you weren't a delegate, I mean, I guess if you were a delegate, couldn't Corey McCray or Antonio Hayes or anybody else then be able to have their own distribution point? And if you make the business, you make the business. If you don't, you don't.
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
Absolutely. And Mark, you know, in the 40th district, this delegate Antonio Hayes.
Yes.
We have a very successful small business brewery and Union Craft Brewery who, because of their success and, you know, and their involvement with the community and hiring so many employees, they're looking for opportunities to expand. And so, you know, most of the employees of Union Craft live within a mile radius walking distance from that brewery. And so they're providing jobs and opportunities for folks right there in the Hamden community. And so it's important that, you know, as these big breweries or these big corporations don't limit the opportunities for small businesses like, you know, Union Craft Brewery and several others to flourish.
Delegate Hayes, the owner of Union Craft, was just in my committee last week when we had the big hearing dealing with Diageo, you know, and everything.
What's Diageo?
Yeah, that's the corporation that wants to bring this mega
brewery. the Guinness Brewery.
Yeah, the Guinness, yeah.
Right.
Produce like
in Jamaica, they think that's a food group.
Five.
Sorry, I didn't mean that. That's what my Jamaican friends say. Yes, Guinness is a food group.
Yeah, man. But I agree with Delegate Hayes. We need to support our small businesses, and they have been around a long time. One lady was there. She's been distributing her craft beer for over 70 years in the state of Maryland. And so we have to support these businesses because they support the infrastructure. They support the people. I have nothing against anybody wanting to bring additional you know, high-powered businesses to the state of Maryland, but we can't do that at the expense of those small businesses that keep us going, you know?
So I guess that's a really hard argument to make, it seems, because we can't seem to get that through in a place that seems to want to, you know, that we try these new ideas, this medical marijuana being one, and you see the majority of people in Maryland believe that marijuana itself should be legalized across the board.
Well, let me just make a final point on the medical marijuana issue. Nothing the commission did was transparent, and they said that they had a double-blind scoring process,
yes,
which they said they used to award the licenses. And I say to people, if that process was blind, Ray Charles can see. That there was nothing blind, nothing. All you got to do is follow the money. Really, when you look to see who got those licenses, it makes no. I mean, I'm not mad at anybody who wants to make a buck, you know. But to say, and for anybody to think that we're going to allow that industry to get up and running in the state of Maryland without the significant African American ownership. We have a third of our population in the state of Maryland is African American. We are not going to do what the rest of the country has done. You know, this is the new oil industry. It, by conservative guesstimates, the gross proceeds in the next 10 years are expected to outweigh those of the NFL and medical marijuana. And why would we allow that? We have 50 members of our Black caucus. We are not going to let that happen in the state of Maryland. And so we have a tough fight ahead of us. It's a political fight, too. But, you know, we have 50 members of the Black caucus who are totally unified on this issue.
So I'm curious what you this, and it's really important. I'm glad you're here in the studio, Cheryl mm-hmm. Glenn, to kind of push that. I think mm-hmm. it's important for people to understand what's going on. Many people right. do not. Let me ask this other question. There's also this bill that would allow people who are addicted to have safe places to do their drugs. Mm-hmm. Highly controversial.
Now, I don't support that. I don't support that.
Let's go around. Let me start with Anna Gutierrez.
Yeah, sure.
Go to Antonio Hayes, Della McCray, and then come over to Cheryl Glenn, and let's see mm-hmm. what you all think about that.
Well, Anna? I think we've seen that these programs do work. In Europe, there are several countries that have taken this approach. I'm just not sure that we here in Maryland or in the United States are quite there yet. I think that it's important to put the idea on the table. It's important for us to think about it. But we're not even at the point of having recreational marijuana be available in Maryland yet. So I'm saying let's take it one step at a time.
Right, Antonio?
Yeah, that bill actually comes to my committee. It's been
which committee is that?
HGO,
the Health and Government Operations Committee, and it's a piece of legislation that's been sponsored by Delegate Moorheim, as you know, is an emergency room doctor, and you know many of us have been trying to figure out how to deal with the opioid addiction issue throughout the state. As a matter of fact, today is the first convening of the opioid task force because there's so many different pieces of legislation to address this issue. But on this one in particular, I think, you know, the electorate and the legislature is just not positioned to go that far, although it is an interesting conversation. And most of the support for it is basically, you know, providing opportunities to save lives. And so having medical doctors and other people on the premises to make sure that people can have access to it. If you remember years ago, the city of Baltimore really took the lead on the needle exchange, which has led to
right.
a dramatic decrease in the amount of intravenous drugs that use needles that populate our community, whether it be reduction of AIDS and other things. And so the concept is a public health model based around saving lives. But I think that there'll be plenty of discussion on it this session, but there's more to go. I also like to highlight, as a part of the opioid task force, one of the things we're going to be looking at, there's a bill called the HOPE Bill, which will provide, other means to treat those who are addicted to substance abuse. Right now, we are, we lack the capacity of about 73,000 just in Baltimore City, as far as, getting access to treatment. A lot of times when someone is looking to, access treatment, we did a good job, especially with the leadership of Black Caucus, passing the Justice Reinvestment Act last year, where nonviolent offenders, especially those who, have an addiction, don't do jail time but to get the treatment, but the treatment beds aren't really readily available. And so we're looking for opportunities to increase some of the community providers' capacity to take on the growing demand, not just in Baltimore but around the state, for addiction services.
And of course, when you look at places like Portugal and Switzerland and other places, they do this, which is actually has saved lives and stop incarcerating people for a simple drug use.
No,
it's
not
very so simple.
Mark, this is Corey McCray. No, I'm not there yet. I think that it's also structural issues, the education system, the police challenges that we have, some of the crime challenges that we have, some of the poverty issues that are making people dependent on different addiction challenges. I think we should get in front of those issues. And I think that we look at some of our schools and the nature that it's in, and I think we have challenges in front of us. So I'll go back to those issues that really hit us home that kind of build on the reason why a lot of our folks are addicted or some of our parents are addicted, and it goes back and forth with the children and things like that. So I'm into solving those structural issues is what I look to first.
And I agree, this is Delegate Glenn, I agree with what my colleagues have said, and we have to focus, we have to do more for drug treatment. We have to really expand on those opportunities. And, you know, I would agree that maybe sometime in the future we can have conversations on this issue, but we have our plates overflowing now, and this is not the time to move forward with having these facilities for people to shoot up and get high, and, you know.
Right, and I think that's so, the overall feeling of the committee. I don't see the legislation going really far, at least that particular piece of legislation, but it's the beginning of a conversation. But we, you know, I don't think, you know, based off of the comments that you heard, that there's not a legislator on his phone that is gung-ho about, you know, supporting
right.
this. You know, it's the beginning of a conversation of how do we, you know, adequately prevent you know, the destruction of losing lives in our community.
Linda writes in, Linda Brown wrote in on Facebook, marijuana, decriminalize it, don't legalize it. The difference between the two is not just a matter of semantics. Things in Colorado have not gone well as legislation has not caught up to legalization of marijuana. This is worth exploration. We should explore that. I don't think I quite agree with Linda, but I think it would be really interesting for us to do a show on how that's worked out in those other states.
Yeah, well, you know, we did decriminalize it last
right.
session, you know, so we still have work to do, but, yeah.
So Melissa Schrober Facebooked in with a question here. Can you ask about House Bill 562 and Senate Bill 1012, she thinks that number is right for the Senate. The former gives the mayor the complete control of city schools. The latter creates a nominating body to recommend candidates. The mayor would select those recommended. The latter approach is used in Boston, which he's talking about in terms of appointing, well, a mixture of appointed school board members. So where do we all stand on this?
I think one of the bills is actually Delegate Antonio Hayes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so we sponsor bill. You know, this has been a major priority of the mayor coming in. And in practice, actually, the current law calls for both the mayor and the governor to appoint. But in all actuality, and over the last couple of years, the mayor has really been the one who's been appointing members of the school board. The governor has pretty much remained solid. And so this bill essentially gives the total authority to the mayor as far as appointing members of the school board to give her, you know, better control and better coordination of city services and the school system. But it also provides an opportunity for a nominating committee made up of stakeholders that are concerned about our young people to include the teachers union, some of the charter school representation, students, and parents as well. And so the bill was heard in front of Ways and Means last week, and we expect it to move forward very soon.
So let me, and this, go ahead, Cheryl.
And I was just going to say one important piece that I really support about this legislation is that it does leave in place the two elected members that we were finally able to get past last session.
Yep.
I believe that we should have more elected.
On the school board.
Yes, on the school board. But we finally, this has been like a 16-year effort. We finally were able to get two people who will be elected in 2022.
I thought not till then.
Yeah, that was due to an amendment from Senator Ferguson. But anyway, we will finally get there in 2022 where we have two members from Baltimore City elected to our school board.
What were you about to say, Anna?
Yes, I'd just like to jump in here. I was an elected school board member here in Montgomery County for 8 years. It was my first jump into elected politics. And let me tell you that it really makes a huge difference from my perspective when you have an elected board. I was elected by the entire county. I was not elected from a small district. So my view on the board was for schools in the entire county for students. I really really think that Baltimore City needs to be moving towards an elected board and direct representation. And I can see it on the Appropriations Committee. Every time that Baltimore City comes with issues about underfunding, cuts, etc., I never see a board member. They don't speak for the city, and they don't seem to be plugged in to what is happening. They don't seem to be making decisions from planning, from budgets, from maintenance. I really think, to me, that's a concern. And I don't know if it's a result of their being appointed, what their limited role is. But we had, at once a month, we had to review every contract over $25,000. That's a direct responsibility for what's happening with a school district. And I think, you know, that kind of oversight is very important.
So I just wanted to say that I do agree with the delegate from my district that we need more elected school members. But I did want to come back in. Typically, there is a school board member at our delegation meeting whenever a board is a bill is introduced. Typically, whenever we have our district meetings, we do have some form of a school board member that's sitting in those meetings. So I don't want to say that all of the appointed board members don't step in. But I do think that, as she stated, we do have challenges and we have to have more people paying attention, which is why I introduced the bill, House Bill 76.
Which is what?
House Bill 76 would basically make sure that when we're doing CIP, Construction Improvement Program, that we have transparency in reference to the large roofs, the windows, the doors, and things of that nature, because as we saw historically in the 45th district, we've been cheated for several years and no one was paying attention. But making sure that not only can the legislators pay attention, the council folks pay attention, but the teachers, the parents, the students can jump in there and make sure that their schools are getting adequately funded when we're talking about the construction and the building of their and maintaining their school buildings.
So there are two issues here we did not get a chance to get to, and we only have like 13 minutes left or so in our conversation, but they're really important. One has to be transparent. But let me ask you first this question about education funding. There's a lot of discussion taking place that we have to drastically change the way we fund education in the state. That's why we have the Kerwin Commission now. Mm-hmm. That's part of what they're going to be doing, And you can see it with the deficit that Baltimore City Schools is facing, $130 million. That has to do with that. It also has to do with the fact that people didn't realize the city was going to have to the city schools were going to have to pay part of the construction out of that money that they get, which is kind of deleting funds from the students. Also, we fell into the trick bag of casinos. People thinking the casinos were going to flood our schools with money, and that was not the case. It was never the case, but it was made to appear the case in all the TV ads and make people vote yes on casinos. So where do we think this should go? What are your thoughts about what a formula would look like
that adequately
funds education, which is the one thing in the state constitution you're supposed to do?
Well, Mark, we have to get rid of that wealth formula. That wealth formula is outdated. It doesn't work because what it's based on is all the development in the city. And so it makes it look like because we've had so much rich development like EBDI, like in the Inner Harbor, and now we have Port Covington coming on. We would our schools wouldn't get any money because it looks like we are wealthy. And so that formula needs to just be, you know, just stricken totally because it's not working. If it's not stricken, it ought to go under a severe revision. And we must have our voices heard. It can't just be the small committee that looks at, you know, this formula. We have to be able to weigh in. The city delegation has to be able to weigh in. And since I've been elected, we've not had that opportunity. But that's something that we need to insist on doing.
Now, so let me go to Ann very quickly before I go to the other two delegates here from Baltimore City, just to get since you're from Montgomery County, the wealthiest county in the state. Mm-hmm. How do you view where the formulas are going and how they're effectively or ineffectively being used in the state?
Well, the wealth formula has always worked against Montgomery County. I mean, forever, it seems to have been established for that. And what's ironic is that we also have the largest school district with the most students in the whole state of Maryland, and we're growing at 3,000 kids per year. That's, 10 elementary schools. Yet the formula does not react to growth in enrollment. However, it does react to decreased enrollment, which is why Baltimore City has lost funding. Clearly, we need to be able to address enrollment directly, head on, and come up with what are the direct costs that must be provided for every student. We go round in circles, and we are not really being equitable to the student. We're being much more driven by, I think, artificial measures of what is the capacity of a school district to provide the level of education that its kids need. We have, for example, just another point, in Montgomery County, now Latinos are the largest percentage of students in the whole district. Many of them, especially in the early grades, are born to non-English speaking parents.
Right.
And I have a bill that's simply going to ask for the MSDE, for the state, to begin to look at dual language programs. Everybody wins in dual language programs. Every child then is taught two languages from very early age, and that develops their brain, their capacity for learning, everything. And it does reflect what is the new direction in the demographics of this country. We have been blind to being at all innovative in reflecting the needs of our community, culturally, linguistically. So, you know, this committee that's been set up, they reported to our Appropriations Committee, and let me tell you, we were all scratching our heads. We had no idea what it was that they were basically clearly focusing that would ensure that our state-level formulas would be responding to the needs of every community in the state.
So, and let me go to Corey McRae, then go to Antonio, and I have to try to get some other questions here before the end of the hour.
So, Mark, just to be clear, the deficit, the 129, is coming from decrease in population, health benefits, the cost of health benefits going up, the cost of retirement benefits going up. You stated with the 21st Century program, and then we initiated some great programs that weren't funded, and we were using other funding sources, such as the allocations, to help with pre-K and things of that nature. So right now, when we talk about the depreciation, that's going double impact because of the programs that we set up with pre-K and from losing those students. And keep in mind that we have the highest poverty. We have a large amount of ESOL students. We have a large amount of folks that's disabled. But one of the things that we need to think about was when the budget secretary came before the Baltimore City delegation, Governor Hogan's budget secretary, he talked about the depreciation being a problem, not only for Baltimore City, but counties on the shore, for jurisdictions like Carroll County. And what happens is the adequacy study is some time off. That's not something that we're going to get recommendations for tomorrow. And these problems are right here in front of us, but they fail to address it inside of their budget, this depreciation within student enrollment. And we need that answer right now, which is why our Dr. Santalisa said that we can't come back for a year fix. We need to come back with 3 years, 5 years. And I believe that she asked for 65, 65, 65 to help address this issue that they know exists, the legislature know exists, and we are doing nothing to get in front of it in reference to our budget.
So the Antonio, let me turn to you. We only have a few minutes left here. We will not get to transparency issues, it doesn't look like today, which is unfortunate, but let me just get to you right away with this. I mean, one of the things that every county in this state has problems with education. Montgomery may be the wealthiest county, but they face serious issues with the growth of students. And as Anna was saying, the numbers of Latino students where English is not their first language when they come to school. Caroline County and County of Eastern Shore are poor counties. They also face serious issues. The kids who grew up in the most desolate neighborhoods in the state are right here in Baltimore City.
Absolutely.
Who live in high poverty. As I said to Carl Stokes on the show the other week, poverty in 1958 and 62 is not the same poverty we see in 2017. There were no vacant houses. There were the broken families didn't exist the same way. Mm-hmm. It wasn't there. Mm-hmm. We have a lot to deal with our children. So the question is, can there be unity in the state, Antonio, do you think, to get people to say we have to put more money into education, rewrite the casino bill, whatever it has to be done to ensure that our kids are taken care of, if that's going to be a priority? I mean, it's not just Baltimore City. We all are affected differently depending on where we live in the state right. by the lack of funding for education.
Right. I think Delegate Gutierrez t- touched on it a little bit. You know, the way our formula, especially in the state, is structured to fund education is not really addressing the needs of the child, right? And the biggest problem that hampers us, you know, in Baltimore City is the way the formula measures wealth is based off of the property taxes. And you know, as Delegate McCray articulated, there's a lot of economic development tools like TIFs, POLITs, and other things where we provide opportunities to grow our city or, you know, get people attracted back to the city. But the city and our government don't actualize the revenues that may have come in through property taxes. And so that's one of the things that we have to look to. Last year, we, you know, with the anticipation of Port Covington coming on board, we provided protections against things such as TIFs, that TIFs where counties like Anne Arundel County have the same issue, to so it won't have a detrimental effect on our funding formula. But, you know, we have enjoyed great communication and cooperation from our colleagues around the state. But I think the most important is the most important point that hopefully the formula would address is identifying ways that we serve the needs of our children, because, you know, there's so many different things that they're encountering even before they get into the classroom. And so I think that's the challenge that the Carowind Commission is going to be facing and making the decision on how do we adequately fund our school systems. I mean, Baltimore City, unlike Montgomery County, has also experienced a decrease in enrollment. And whereas, you know, and so has counties like Carroll County and counties on the shore. And so whereas the governor came to the rescue of Carroll County and provided additional funding for them, we would, you know, he withheld him, the Board of Public Works withheld $5 million just on the issue of air conditioning. So I think we just need to refocus our priorities and making sure that we're seeing to the needs of our young people throughout the state of Maryland.
So we only have like 2 minutes left here. Just a quick closing thought. And Anne, let me go to you and then come to Cheryl, but very, very quick closing thoughts. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think there can be unity around this issue between places like Montgomery County and Baltimore City?
Do I think that what?
Do you think there can be unity around this kind of issues between places like Montgomery County and Baltimore City?
I think so, because we're all interested in the welfare and the education of children. I think that the way that we go about it may need to be reformed, revised. Let me tell you, Montgomery County has traditionally made education the highest priority for funding.
Right.
We were 75% of our local budget goes into education. I don't know what Baltimore City does. I know that it receives, an unequal amount of state money. For example, for school construction, 97-98% of school construction costs are paid by the state. 50% are what are paid in Montgomery County.
So, Delegate, I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you, because we're just about, we have 30 seconds left out of time. I promise Cheryl she could also have a quick closing thought.
I think that we need to be upfront.
Anna. they only have a few seconds. Listen, I do believe that Baltimore City and Montgomery County will be able to bridge whatever differences we have on that issue. But I also wanted to get in HBCUs. That's another big issue. And we have the HBCU Night in Annapolis coming up on Tuesday, March 21st from 6 to 8 p.m. That's a huge issue. The whole nation is watching to see what the state of Maryland will do on the issue of the HBCUs.
So you have 15 seconds to give us, Corey?
Just thanks for the opportunity, Mark.
It's good to have you all here. I wish we had another hour. There's so much to talk about, but you all have been phenomenal. It's been a really, very substantive discussion.
Thank you.
I appreciate the work the four of you are doing and the fact that you came in for the substantive discussion today. Delegate Anna Sol Gutierrez from District 18 in Montgomery County. Always good to have you with us, Anna. Thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me. I'd love to come back.
We will be back. Delegates Corey McCray and, of course, Cheryl T. Glenn from District 45, Cheryl Glenn being the chair of the Black Caucus in the Maryland State Legislature, and Delegate Antonio Hayes from District 40. Antonio, glad you could join us as well.
Yes, thank you.
Good to have you all here. We got to take a short break, and we're going to take a trip into the Oscars and more. Don't go away.